My objective when I arrived here, and I used to talk about this with everybody, was to leave the club in a better place than I picked it up. And if I did that, then there is some success in that. We had a lot of incredible memories, and we did a lot of incredible things. And I think the club is destined to keep doing that. It's time for somebody else to take that.
In a different world, we would have kept the two bigs, but I do think, it was an incredible luxury to have those two, and we thank them for obviously everything they accomplished. They were here, huge parts of winning the championship here. But I do think, we're really excited with Aaron. He's as accomplished not only in the NBA but internationally as well. Creates a great opportunity for Chris Boucher to step into a more consistent role.
Little Bobby Webster, little Greg Vanney. Big anniversary today. 25 years since Patrick Waugh played his last game with the Montreal Canadiens. And how about a little Alan Walsh Twitter action? Jam that into our veins on a Wednesday morning in early December, Ziggy. If we can't have actual hockey, if we're in the middle of the offseason still, Mr. Walsh, come to the rescue.
Are we going to go through all his tweets today, or what are you thinking for that?
Well, I think it would be important not just to talk about them, but if we're going to talk about them, we got to read them.
Let's go through them. I can't wait to do that. I mean, he's say what you want. He cares. He knows a lot. He's not afraid to voice his opinion. And it's really interesting.
Maybe he's a player.
It's great for us in the morning.
If you don't know who Alan Walsh is, well, we should start by introducing him. He's a player agent. And Marc-Andre Fleury, you may remember in the playoffs when Robin Leonard ended up starting a game or two for Vegas, it was Alan Walsh who tweeted the sword. The sword through Marc-Andre's back with the name DeBoer imprinted on the sword. So he's an activist agent for his players, and he is an activist agent at times for the NHLPA. So he initially yesterday quote tweeted a story about the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League and quote tweeted it by saying that hybrid bubbles work. So
yeah, they're off. They canceled the season. Well, they paused the season to the first week of January.
Right. So, yeah. But he's saying hybrid bubbles work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then he got a little deeper. The NHL is soft floating the idea with media that if no deal, and remember when I read this, it's shortened because of the 280 characters and all that. So I'm going to try and add words to give it context, but here we go. The NHL is soft floating the idea with media that if there is no deal with the NHLPA, or that if no deal is reached with the NHLPA on the return to play, it can unilaterally invoke force majeure, that's the so-called act of God clause, to cancel the 2020-2021 season. In reality, if the NHL cancels the season because the players won't give them another $300 million in concessions, that is a lockout, which is expressly prohibited by the CBA Article 7.1B. If the NHL lawyers are advising owners they have a winning case here, I suggest they go back to law school. Owners will be subjecting themselves to billions in potential damages if they falsely invoke force majeure to cancel the season. And then he came back an hour later. Maybe he had dinner or something. And then he came back an hour later. One more point. What about the NHL owners who also own NBA teams where both teams play in the same buildings? The NBA regular season is starting December the 22nd. However, the NBA owners who also own NHL teams will invoke force majeure due to the pandemic and cancel the NHL season? Now, that was the point I was making the other day in a roundabout way. How can you, and I was speaking more generally about the NHL, how can you claim act of God, force majeure, specific to the pandemic, when you're looking around and you're seeing the NFL try to bulldoze its way through the season. We got a game, a huge game in the AFC North at 3:40 this afternoon between the Ravens and the Steelers, rescheduled for like three or four times, and are apparently going to play today. So the NFL is bulldozing its way through. Major League Baseball, with a lot of acrimony in the lead up, figured out a 60-game season and saw playoffs and a World Series through to the end. And the NBA is starting training camps as we speak, is due to tip off in 20 days, and just announced yesterday a 5-game Christmas Day slate that doesn't include the Raptors, but we're not going to talk about that just yet because we need to stay focused. I mean, here's the thing, Ziggy. All of these things have peaks and valleys and arcs. I can't tell the degree to which Walsh is just letting loose on Twitter or the degree to which he is legitimately concerned that there won't be any kind of season at all. Not a season that starts late, like January 15th, February 1st, whatever, but that there won't be a season at all.
Well, first off, I think agents have to be worried just for their businesses. This is like their livelihood. And if they're going to have the NHL cancel a season because they're not happy with the deal they signed 5 months ago, you're going to see a lot of them come out, and a lot of them are going to be vocal. We know Alan Walsh is more vocal than most hockey agents, but you have to wonder, right? So that's the first thing. Agents around pro sports, and now if your sport's going to be, you know, canceled or postponed, there a lot of them are going to speak up. I know you've said that. How can basketball play? How can you be not concerned about your basketball team in the NBA, but be concerned about your NHL team, or if that's whatever your building's where it's played, or you own both of them? It's the best point to make. I'm all for that point.
My point is, force majeure is the pandemic. It is specific to the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
right? So there are losses tied to COVID-19, a reduction in gate revenue, probably a reduction in merchandise sales, certainly a reduction in concession sales. I mean, there are no asses in the seats. There are no people to stand up from their chairs and go into the concessions and buy some popcorn, some beer, and some hot dogs. So I understand that there are losses here, but if other leagues are incurring losses themselves yet going ahead, that would, and I'm not a lawyer, I think I've probably proven that in the last 3 minutes, but that would show me that it is possible to play. It is possible to run a fully successful, or at least somewhat successful, if we're ranking success on the number of positive tests, it is possible to run a somewhat successful season. Other leagues are doing it, so why can't you? This is a fiscal financial issue. This is not a pandemic issue, although fiscal financial is tied to the disease.
Yeah, that's going to be a big point, I think. And yeah, how can you come back with your NBA team and not your NHL? You said it was fine for one, but why is it not? Why has it not good for your other league? Yeah, I think that's going to be a huge talking point going forward.
They would argue that their take home of the national television deals in the NBA is much higher, right? Because the NBA has a couple billion dollars worth of national television contracts, whereas the NHL is into the low hundreds of millions.
What I'm confused about, and something I'm sure it's going to come up, is the U.S. deal is up after this year. So if they don't play, how's that going to work? Because they're not going to fulfill their TV deal, right? I'm sure that's a big issue for the NHL. And I mean, maybe they can get out of it with the force majeure clause. Like maybe they can get out of their U.S. deal, because that's a big one for them not playing this year. Let's not forget that. The NHL can say whatever they want to the media or whatever kind of, you know, take they want to take in negotiations, but they have to fulfill that last year. A big reason why they came back last year, one, handing out the Stanley Cup is important. The second biggest one is fulfilling their TV deals. It's not just the amount of money they would have lost this year. It's the amount, you know what I mean? that money would have had to get paid back to the networks that had signed deals for this past year. Let's not forget that. That was a big reason why the season was finished a lot later. So I
help me with my math here, Zig. Make your point and then I'll do my math here and help me with my math. Go ahead.
I'm just so under the CBA, they cannot lock the players out. And if they use this force majeure clause, okay, yeah. How can you make your other league play and not take that stance? But the thing about it is, why can't the NHL just say, I don't think it's safe for my players to play the season? They're going to say, well, your NBA is playing. They're going to say, well, that's, you know, the rosters are smaller. I can distance the players on the bench. In hockey, that's not possible. There's more players to carry, and we can't operate. That's why I...
Yeah, but in the NHL...
I'm sure that's not a legal stance to take.
No, but in the NFL, they've got 100 people on the sidelines. In Major League Baseball, the dugouts are stuffed with guys, some wearing masks, some not.
And I'm not sticking up for the league or telling them the leg they're standing on is... You know, they can do that, but why can't the NHL just say, we don't find this safe for our players? Look what happened in Major League Baseball. Players were testing positive. Look what's happening in the NFL. Games are being moved.
Would you honestly believe that the National Hockey League is making a decision of this magnitude in the best interest of its players and players' health? Yeah. That would be the sole... Not just the sole reason, the main reason of multiple reasons. Zero chance.
Yeah, I know.
Somebody cue Vince McMahon's theme music. No chance in hell. No chance in hell.
I'm just saying, if the NHL's trying to get out of the season because the losses are going to be so big and they can't get out of the CBA they signed in July, and okay, it's going to cost them billions of dollars if they lock the players out. Like, good luck going to get that money.
Okay.
Like, it's not happening.
But help me with my math here. So they struck that agreement in the summer, right? Mm. Effectively, the players at that point would stand to take home 72% of their salaries this year. The NHL is going back for an additional $300 million it says it's going to lose. How many teams play in the NHL?
31. I know, it's 9 million or 8 million a team.
Help me with 300 million divided by 31. It's less than 10 schmil a team.
I know, you're telling me you're going to cancel a season for 10 million? Not happening. Getting insight into the lockout. So during my career, I was there for the 04-05 lockout.
Full season,
and then the second one was
12-13.
Yeah, 12-13. I can tell you this much. The league is not as united as you and I and everybody else thinks.
You're talking about the league or the Players Association?
The league.
The league.
The NHL. Just from what I heard from 04-05, it was like the top teams in the league apparently were just like, okay, uncle, like this has to end.
Well, why would the Leafs and Rangers and Red Wings and high other revenue generating teams care?
Yeah, but the problem is that however their voting system works, it's the majority of the, like, there's so many votes that have to, you know, go through for when they try to make all these decisions. And a lot of those teams are teams that just, in quotation, struggle to get by.
Well,
they're still making lots of money, but the teams that don't bring in the revenue, they actually decide kind of what happens. I'm sure the top earning organizations can put pressure on them, but at the end of the day, they call the shots. The teams that are middle of the road or aren't making the money that the top teams are making.
You know, when Gary Bettman retires, it will be a fascinating biography of his career, but he deserves a ton of credit on this particular point. Look at where the game is played now, right? When he arrived in the NHL San Jose was just becoming a thing. There was no team in Dallas. Minnesota moved to Dallas almost right away. There were no teams in Florida.
Florida, we love Florida.
There was no team in North Carolina like there is now. There was no team in Nashville. And some of these franchises that I've just named, Arizona, obviously, some of these teams that I've just named, Anaheim, they do quite well. Tampa Bay, Nashville, but it wasn't always that way. And it wasn't necessarily that way 15 years ago. I know the Lightning won the Cup leading into the full season lockout, but Jeff Vinnick is the owner who eventually came in and settled all of that stuff down. And he did that about a decade ago. Nashville went through some serious drama at times in its early stages. So the system that they have created works. And I would think one of the many things that Gary Bettman reminds the bigger market, more traditional hockey markets of is we did the Southern and Southwestern expansion to grow this game across the continent. Those teams, they may not be thriving, each one of them, but at the very least, our weakest link has to be able to survive. Mm-hmm. And somehow, some way, well, we know based on the parameters of the CBA, they have managed to ensure the survival of everybody in the Southern Belt, save for the Atlanta Thrashers.
Yeah, you have to take care of those teams. I get all that, and Gary Bettman's done a great job with expanding the league and, you know, finding, you know, different corners of the United States to throw teams, and, you know, that's been great, and expansion's been great, and hey, I 2 years of my six or seven that I played in the NHL were, you know, in Phoenix, Arizona, where can anybody believe there's hockey there? I mean, you know, when they first got their expansion team, when they moved from Winnipeg.
Now one of the best players in the league is from there.
Is from there, exactly. And then Carolina, you know, I mean, having NHL hockey in Raleigh. So when Hartford moved down there. So, yeah, I owe a lot to those expansion teams in the NHL finding different markets to play in. But, yeah, they're going to have to take care of those teams when – you know, at the table, they're the majority. And I just don't think the NHL is united as everybody thinks. And I'm sure that's part of the commissioner that runs the league. I'm sure that's maybe at the top of his priority list on things to handle. So
see,
he usually does a good job with it, right?
I feel like I got a yay or nay you on something here. Cause last week we yayed or nayed 48 game season starting sometime in January, not the 1st of January, but a little bit later. And you yayed that.
Yeah. I didn't think it would wait till February. And has it changed now? Yeah.
Well, let's do a quick impromptu.
Okay.
Yay or nay.
All right.
Okay. Yay or nay. We'll start small and work our way up. And if you nay the first one, then there's no point in going forward. Yay or nay. There will be a season.
Yay.
Yay!
Did you say yay just because if you nade it, then you're like, where are we going next?
No, that's
I know.
I really do for $300 million at the end of the day. Like, that's right. Not fooling it. You can fool everybody with, okay, we don't want to play because of health reasons. Okay, fine. But for $300 million, that's not fooling
anyone. This is the Bettman escalator moment. Okay. We're in that Bettman escalator moment of early 2013 where we're done. And then a week later they had something. I do think that this isn't a lockout, but I do think these issues between league and players association do take on a bit of a soap opera drama arc every now and then. And I feel like we're in one of those right now. So we're yaying a season, yay or nay. Puck is dropped on a regular season game by the end of January, January 31st or earlier, yay or nay?
I think it's going to be February, so I'll nay it. Yeah, I think it's going to go into February, but they can get a 48 game season. I think it was 48 games this whole time. I don't think there was a chance at 80. I don't think there was a chance at
It's just, like the baseball thing, Zig, right?
When it was
like
the baseball exactly.
Where the owners were saying, here's this proposal with this amount of pro rata. Here's this proposal for a number of games with this amount of pro rata. The owners are trying to, and you, what you end up doing is you squeeze their you-know-whats by pushing them up against the wall and a deadline. Like, we got to poop or get off the pot here because it's almost New Year's.
Yeah, I think that does a number of things, right? It talks down the Players Association, so you're going to get the best deal from the players. If you know you're going to lose money, you're going to lose the minimum amount. You keep the season on. Another thing does, you keep the season on because if you stop playing, we've seen this year, people will find other things to do. And the other thing it does is it fulfills your TV rights.
Yeah.
Obviously, you don't get, maybe everything you had in your original deal, but you will fulfill those rights to the networks. And that's a big part of it. Let me tell you, I think it's right there with the deal, the CBA you set up with the players is your network deals. I think they've got to be 1A and 1B. So,
well, and I do think if from an on ice product perspective, if we get this Canadian division, seven teams, Maple Leafs, Senators, Habs, Jets, Flames, Oilers, Canucks, 48 games. That means you've got six opponents. You play them eight times each. And you go out west and you get Winnipeg twice. You get Calgary twice. You get Edmonton twice. You get Vancouver twice. And you circle back. You play a bit of a homestand and you go out there two or three times and you knock those games off. And they come to you two or three times and you play chunks of games. I think it's very, from the Canadian division perspective, I think it's a pretty easy and obvious schedule to put together. I mean it's not like you're fighting with, I mean, the Leafs are the only team that could have a possible other sports team create a schedule difficulty, and that ain't happening right now because the Raptors are playing in Tampa. So, you know, the buildings are available. Concerts aren't happening. Motocross isn't happening. The circus ain't coming to town. It's COVID, baby. You know, like. Yeah.
I'm just, maybe the league. Another thing about this, the Alan Walsh tweets, sort of keep going back to that. And the league trying to negotiate with the players is, why can't the league go to the players and say, I know I keep bringing this up and going back to it, but why can't they just keep going back to them and making this a health issue? Okay, you want to come back? We're not going to insure anybody. You want to come back? You need to sign off on it that we're not responsible for you or your family. Like, I'm sure the NFL, the NBA, and Major League Baseball has something in there that ensures the safety or covers them in case of an emergency. And I'm not, you know, wishing harm on anybody or any group, but I'm just trying to think of what the NHL is going to do to try to get out of this season. And I don't know why they can't make it health related where they don't don't cover them from an insurance standpoint. Like, you guys want to come back. We don't feel that it's the need to come back. We're not going to cover you guys. Like, I just feel like there's so many different ways out of it for the NHL if they wanted to do that. I'm more of on the side of, you know, I view this as just posturing by the NHL and how they're just trying to get the best deal and make it the shortest season as possible. But there's so many ways out of it. It's not, you know, I'm surprised the force majeure. I'm sure the force majeure is the only legal way out of it. But from a health standpoint, if you're a player and the league's like, you guys want to come and play, you're on your own. We're not responsible at all.
At Walsh A on Twitter, we very rarely throw out Twitter handles.
Yes,
he's worth a follow. Stories we're on today: Greg Vanney out as head coach of Toronto FC, and what a run he had in six plus seasons. 2017 MLS Cup champ, three times he led Toronto FC to the MLS Cup final with that one victory, and Toronto FC went further than anybody from MLS in the CONCACAF Champions League when they were a finalist in 2018. He left an amazing imprint. Who knows where he ends up next, but he will be remembered fondly in this town. The Raps are gathering in Tampa for training camp. Terrence Davis, as the NBA and police handle a domestic violence allegation, is with the team and the Raptors. Bobby Webster, the GM, are saying, look, this is a league issue right now. The NBA, from a league perspective, is handling the investigation into this matter. Mike Tyson wants a go with Evander Holyfield. I couldn't have predicted that. Oh, wait, I did the other day. Bruce Arians and Tom Brady, it ain't exactly lovey-dovey down in Tampa Bay. We'll discuss that. And Hugh jumps into studio with us. Hugh is a fan of the toilet seats. And 25 years ago, probably literal toilet seats, but also the NHL team with a toilet seat logo. 25 years ago tonight, December the 2nd, 1995, it was a Saturday night at the now-defunct Montreal Forum. The Detroit Red Wings, the Montreal Canadiens. Patrick Waugh was left in goal by head coach Mario Tremblay in a blowout. After the ninth puck got past Patrick Waugh.
Yeah, yeah, we get it.
Tremblay pulled him. There was a stare down at the bench. Patrick Waugh went over to Ronald Corey, Habs president, sitting right behind the Habs bench. And if you're going, well, how did he speak to him? There was no plexiglass back then separating.
No.
Patrick Waugh said, I'm done in Montreal. And the rest was history. Brian Savage, former Montreal Canadian, will join us at 7 o'clock. He was on that team. And we will discuss that historic day in Habs and NHL history with Hugh next. About that night in Berlin in 2017.
The sounds.
You can't stand that this is a rave music.
It sounds like a rave or an 80s video game.
You know? Could be both.
Yeah. Good tune.
So Ziggy, I mean, we got to figure out, Hugh, how did you read your update and text the show at the same time?
Uh-oh.
I can multitask.
This isn't good.
I'm curious about this thing.
Oh, man. Thanks for bringing up horrible memories. I'm a diehard Habs fan, and that 11-1 loss to Detroit was my first and only game I saw live at the Montreal Forum. Ah, well, at least everyone remembers it.
Yeah, if you only go to one, that would certainly be a memorable one.
Did you guys ever watch a game there?
I never got a chance to go to the forum.
I got to the then Molson Center. I've been to the Molson Bell Center a few times now, but the first time I was there was in the early spring, like March of 1998. So I missed the forum by, what, 2 or 3 years?
Yeah. It's one of my life's great regrets. Never got
there. Yeah.
Like Ziggy, you could attest to this. Like Maple Leaf Gardens, you know, one of the cathedrals of hockey, the old Boston Garden, and, you know, Montreal Forum. I mean, those would be Madison Square Garden, the old Madison Square Garden before all the renos.
Yeah, I went for a tour. So in Boston, played, you know, minor hockey tournaments, and usually would go to one every year in Montreal. And right before both of them were torn down, I got to go in and do a tour of them, which was kind of neat, but. Yeah, getting to go and watch a game there would have been a thrill.
Yeah,
and Maple Leaf Gardens, got to play there as a, you know, in the OHL as a junior player, which was kind of neat. Wasn't the NHL, but we got to see them practice before the game. And then we would go on, you know, 2-3 hours later. So that was always a thrill going in there to play St. Mike's.
I'm just thinking what it must have been like to go to a Habs game at the Forum when things were really heady. Imagine just.
Yeah.
You get your tickets. They're probably less than $10 each. You throw back about 8 to 10 Molson X's or Labatt 50s, and you just smoke cigs all night while you watch your
ads,
hockey team win.
No ads on the boards.
Nope.
Just short glass.
Yep.
Tight rink.
Larry
loud.
Robinson just up and down the ice, back and forth. Guy Lafleur with the hair flowing, smoking cigarettes in between shifts.
I mean, think of the starting five. Or starting six, I guess, that they had back in the day. You know, Lafleur, Schutt, Lemaire, Savard, Lapointe, Dryden. Or, you know, substitute Lapointe for Robinson. That's not bad. That's not a bad
This is going to be lineup. One hell of a segment to put on our demo tape when we when we apply for work in Montreal.
Yep.
When we're starting to push the boundaries here of decency.
Well,
all right,
some events transcend all fan bases. This was a league-wide event.
Oh God.
It had ramifications throughout the league.
Yes. So, and Brian Savage, former Montreal Canadian, is going to join us at the top of the 7 o'clock hour. He was on that Habs team.
Yeah.
And we'll get the inside dirt from him. Because I think the one thing that's obvious without sitting here and having the context is that didn't just start and end that night.
No.
You don't give up.
It's been simmering for a while.
Yeah. Tremblay doesn't leave Wah in for 9 goals because things are good. Wah doesn't blow past him,
staring at him, glaring.
Tell him some words that we probably can't repeat here, and then make a beeline to the end of the bench, lean over the railing into the first row of seats, and whisper to Ronald Corey, the then Canadiens team president, "I'm done." That doesn't start on Saturday afternoon and end that way Saturday night.
Can either of you guys imagine a scenario where that happens today? At the time, arguably Patrick Roy was maybe one of the brightest stars in the NHL, if not the best player, certainly in the top three.
He was the money goaltender.
So who's the best goalie in the NHL right now? If you had to pick one.
Hellebuck, Vasilevsky, one of them.
Okay, yeah. So Vasilevsky.
Or you could even use the Montreal example and say Carey Price.
Sure, whether sure.
You, yeah.
So
I think you could use Carey Price, absolutely. Yeah.
So imagine Carey Price blowing by Claude Julien on the bench and then walking over to the owner and basically getting in his face saying, "I'm done. Period. End of story." It just wouldn't happen today, right? Probably because there's glass behind the bench and everything like that, but still.
But Wah had such cachet to write the 2 Stanley Cups.
Yeah. And I mean, being a lifelong Habs fan, like, this probably affects me, and I remember more about this than probably your average fan, but it was a clash of egos. That essentially, what you're right, that's what it came down to, Scott. It was a clash of egos. Mario Tremblay, 4-time Cup winner, by the way, head coach of the Montreal Canadiens, thought that he was bigger than the best goalie to ever play the game. And here's a clip of Mario Tremblay after it all went down. I believe it's from the next morning when he was just grilled by reporters. Maybe it was, I don't think it was post-game. I think it was the next day.
Maybe I could have tell him to come at the bench after the 7 goals, maybe. But, you know, I don't think it's 2 goals who's gonna change a career.
I think it was.
That's where he is incredibly wrong. Yeah, those 2 goals changed not only a career, but the course of 2 franchises.
You know, Hugh, it's 25 years later and your face is still turning the color of the Habs red jersey. You're
they blue blanc et rouge. Yeah.
Still
something I don't something angry. I don't think
le pissed off.
Le pissed off.
Something I think people overlook, and I know we can get into it with Brian, but they were roommates and played together.
When they played.
Rookie year, they were roommates. Exactly.
Yeah. So that's a different dynamic, I think. I'm just trying to think of guys I've roomed with and then having one of them coach. I think there can be some issues with that.
Like a power struggle, you think, maybe?
Just,
like, I'll show you who the boss is, kind of thing.
Yeah, you could get some of that. And then if it didn't go well, because I know some guys that room together were just like, "Please get me away from this guy." I can remember situations like that. And then imagine one of those guys going to coach you.
Yeah.
So it could cause there could be a lot of friction there, right? So, you know, I'm sure Brian Savage will have a better idea and what that was like and that dynamic, and he'll have some insight more on when they're roommates and the issues there. But so there was that. They had an issue, and so when Tremblay went to coach. Apparently, him and Waugh got into a huge battle at like some cafe. And I know,
Schwartz's.
Yeah,
deli?
I don't know where. Yeah, I don't know where, but I heard there was like some issue when he started to coach the team because he came in partway through that 95 season, right?
Yeah, it was 95-96.
Rajon Uhl had only been on the job as general manager for like a month.
Had they blown out Jacques Demers earlier that year, or was there somebody in between?
I don't remember that. I think he came in for him. But anyways, he came in at that 95.
Was relatively new. Yeah.
Something happened in a cafe. I'd love to get into, I'm sure we'll dig into that.
There was an incident apparently in a hotel lobby bar where Tremblay saw Waugh in there having a few and basically told him to get out. Like, get out.
Well,
of the bar.
maybe that was it then. It may be cafe or bar.
No, I think you're right. I think there was another incident at a cafe as well. There was also an incident in practice where Mario Tremblay blasted one and almost hit Juan in the throat with a slap shot.
That wouldn't go over.
Yeah, I remember that too.
Imagine that from your coach.
Well, Brian Savage, there's going to be some juice. The statute of limitations is long past.
But here's talk about having the last laugh though. So Patrick Waugh gets traded to Colorado 4 days after this. In his first game against the Habs that he plays, they win 4-2, and Waugh's outstanding. It's amazing. I think he stopped like 37 or 38 shots. Takes the game puck, flips it at Tremblay. There you go. Then later on, a couple months later, won the Stanley Cup. So that's your last laugh there.
It's on Sportsnet Central right now when Waugh's walking by Tremblay. I feel like he walked by him the first time to send a message to him.
Yep.
And then it was almost like he didn't like his body language.
Well, Tremblay had the arms folded.
Yeah. I think
staring, glaring right back at him as he walked by too.
Yeah. What I'd like to know, and probably only the guys that will know this were on the benches. So he walks by him the first time, says something. Who's behind the bench? The owner, the president,
Ronald Corey,
plus a lot of the Habs all time.
Yeah, like Jean Beliveau and his wife always.
They all
sat
line
there.
Up. Yeah. So I feel like he went by, sent the message, and he didn't like the body language from Tremblay. So he went by him once, twice, and then went by him the third time, and I think that's when he said, this is my last game.
Yeah.
Like, I get me out of here.
Right, and then it took a couple of days until the trade was made, but if you go back in history, the Colorado Avalanche had just moved to Denver from Quebec. So, two parts to that. Number one, the Montreal Canadiens never would have traded Patrick Waugh to Quebec. That would have been politically impossible. It's not just a sports thing.
Would the Leafs ever trade Austin Matthews to the Habs? No.
Okay, no, but it's not. Leafs Habs is a sports thing.
Yes.
It may also be a bit of a Toronto Montreal thing
between Quebec City and Montreal.
But Montreal is half Anglophone. Quebec is predominantly Francophone. You were about a decade removed from the Good Friday Massacre, the Quebec Montreal playoff game where the Hunter brothers were on either side, and it was just a yard sale and just a brawl. So you had the political and social stuff. That never could have happened. And the other thing I wonder is, given the importance and the social dynamic that the Montreal Canadiens have in that province, were the Habs more likely to want to do a deal with a team like Colorado because they were getting a French-Canadian goaltender in return?
Jocelyn Thibault,
In Jocelyn Thibault. Did that matter? I would love to know what, if any, other significant offers were on the table from other teams. Because if everything else was the same and Colorado was still in Quebec, one of those other trades would have been made.
Yeah, well, Roy backed the team into a corner, obviously, because he demanded the trade. And so the Habs were never going to be dealing from a position of strength there. I remember the whole Tremblay ego thing. I remember an interview with Jacques Demers talking about Patrick Waugh and how good he was and how much he meant to the team. And Demers said, no, I don't treat Patrick like I treat the other players. You don't treat the best goaltender in the game like you would treat the seventh defenseman. Patrick Roy didn't want to practice. He didn't have to practice. If you wanted to leave practice early, that's fine. Nobody batted an eyelid. Mario Tremblay wasn't going to let that fly. And that's where the clash came in.
Right. It's like Pat Burns here in Toronto.
Yeah.
He and Doug Gilmore developed a relationship, a rapport. Coach, captain. He wasn't captain at the time, but important. Coach, best player.
By the way, I have a trivia question for you guys. You guys like the trivia? Zig, you ready?
All right.
Okay. So Patrick Roy was pulled after giving up 9 goals to Detroit. Who replaced him?
It wouldn't have been Red Light Rassico.
No, sir.
It was past that.
I have no idea.
Too early for Jeff Hackett.
Too early for Jeff Hackett.
God, who would have been? I have no idea.
Pat Jablonski.
Oh, my God. All right.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a name I remember, but I would not have gotten.
Pat Jablonski, who, by the way, picked up a win in the Habs' next game against New Jersey, a 4-2 win, and then Jocelyn Thibault came in and made his first start.
And so did Andrei Kovalenko and Marty Rutschinski.
Oh, yes.
You know what's interesting about the trade, though, was who went with Patrick Roy. That's for me was...
Yeah, Mike Keane, right?
Yeah, he was the cap. Like the captain. He was the captain. So I'm wondering, did he go in and say, hey, this is all wrong? Like, you shouldn't have done that. Go and apologize. Let's smooth this out. And they're like, yeah, you're out of here too. Or did he give him, say, you guys make this better or get rid of me as well? Like, when do you trade your captain?
Questions for Brian Savage.
Yeah, we've got a lot cooking right now.
The Jeopardy column is questions for Brian Savage. And Ziggy just came with the $1,000 question. And Brian Savage, former Montreal Canadian, who was there that night 25 years ago. When Patrick Roy made it clear he was done with the Canadiens. He will join us at the top of the 7 o'clock hour. Dan Schulman. So we talked to Dan, about a month ago when he was nominated for the Frick Award. He is a finalist to enter the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. Well, he is the winner this year of the Jack Graney Award, and he is going in to the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. Dan will be along at the 7:30 segment to discuss that. We'll congratulate him. Catherine Tappan of the NHL on NBC at the top of the 8 o'clock hour, and our buddy Adnan Virk at 8:30. Right now, 416-870-0590, 416-870-0590. We are looking to give away $100 in Untuckit gift cards, and we will look to do that when we play All or Nothing next.
It's time to play All or Nothing with Ziggy and Scotty Mac on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
We got $100 we want to give away in Untuckit gift cards. We play this game daily at this time. It's All or Nothing. 3 true or false questions. You got to get them all right or get them all wrong. So, Ziggy, don't hang up if you get question number 1 wrong because...
You got to get question number 2 and 3 wrong, Scotty, for all the cash.
I just wanted to let that one play out. Silent Vic, you've got a drop. Here we go. Mark in Hamilton. How are you, Mark?
Not too bad. Yourself?
We're doing very well, and you're going to be better here in a minute when you've got $100 in Untuckit gift cards. Ziggy, you got question number 1.
All right, the NBA Christmas Day schedule just came out, and the Raptors are not going to be playing that day. True or false?
True.
That is correct. There are 5 games being played. The Raptors caused a little bit of issue, Scotty. A lot of people and the T-Dot not happy. I'm okay with it, though.
Dear Steph Curry, you get to spend Christmas in Milwaukee. Hugh, you got question 2. Mark, get the next 2 correct and you're good.
All right, Mark, you sound like a Habs fan. Is that true?
Absolutely not.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
Yes, thank you. You
just
win.
Give him ding, the gift ding. Cards now. Give him the gift cards now.
Damn it. I could have swore you were a Habs fan. Okay, Mark. No, it was 25 years, although you're probably going to get this one then. It was 25 years ago tonight. Patrick Roy played his last game in a Habs uniform. The team lost 11-1 that night to the Boston Bruins. True or false?
True.
Oh, no.
Mark, he said he was a Red Wings fan, right? I heard that. They lost to the Red Wings 11-1.
You tipped him off, too.
I know.
I was like, you gave him the answer.
Ziggy, I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
No, you know what it was? I'm going to jump to Mark's defense. I think he heard the score. And it clicked with him, and he just blurted out true because 11-1
yeah,
was. I think that's what happened there.
Oh, wow. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because the score was on, but the team was off. Oh, heartbreaking.
It was a loss to the Detroit Red Wings. Okay, yeah. So that's bad news for Mark and Hamilton, but it's good news for you. We'll double the amount. $100 becomes $200 in Nantucket gift cards when we play All or Nothing at this time tomorrow morning. Adnan Virk at 8:30. Catherine Tappan of the NHL on NBC at the top of the 8 o'clock hour. Dan Schulman's going into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. We'll celebrate with him at 7:30. And up next, 25 years later, from a man who was on the bench, former Montreal Canadiens player Brian Savage, on the night that Patrick Waugh told Habs president Ronald Corey in the middle of a hockey game, I will never wear this jersey again. The lead up and the night that was with Brian Savage next. Kevin in Ajax is speaking my language. Whoa, Ziggy, back off. Ziggy just came back on FaceTime, and it was an Uber close-up.
I know you were worried I wasn't back. I was reading something.
I think you got some lettuce online in between your teeth there, pal. That was...
Was it too close? That's just a gap between my teeth. It's not lettuce. Thank you for noticing,
though.
I got
a good look at the chiclets on. Wow, he's smiling this morning.
Oh, he's smiling. Come on, buddy.
You're a happy guy. Kevin in Ajax, speaking my language, can we please stop talking about the Raptors on Christmas? It won't ever happen. Well, that's not true. It's happened a couple of times, including last year. But I will agree with Kevin. I look at it this way. If the Raptors play a game on Christmas Day, I miss it. I'm having dinner with my family. If they play on Boxing Day, I'll be able to sit down and watch it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? I know it's a thing. I know it matters. I know, but like we get pissed off. There are many certainties in life: death, taxes, us getting pissed off when the Blue Jays are forced to play a 12:30 in the afternoon playoff game because we're not in America, and people getting mad when the Raptors don't play a game on Christmas. It's not the end of the world.
Well, they played the Celtics last year and lost. So, yeah, I don't understand why we're so concerned about that in Toronto, and we feel disrespected when we have one of the best teams in the league we should be playing. This is a U.S. broadcast, is it not?
It is.
These games are broadcasted in the U.S.
Right. And they gave us a game last year because our team was the defending NBA champ.
I'm sorry to break it to everyone, but it's not a priority for the networks in the U.S. to have the Raptors play on Christmas. There's so many good young stars.
So much legitimate stuff to be mad at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. I don't understand why. I was on, try to get a pulse on what Raps Nation is feeling when the Christmas Day schedule came out, and a lot of people aren't happy.
Well, of course, it's a thing. I get it. It's a thing. It's cachet. We've now equated. I mean, when you and I were growing up, Ziggy, Christmas Day, I don't even think was a thing in the NBA. So it's a newer thing. It signifies cachet. It signifies that you're a draw. It signifies that you're one of the top teams in the NBA, and there's a respect afforded to that. But I can tell you right now, a team the quality of the Raptors playing in a different market would would get the love. It's got nothing to do with whether this is a well-run organization or a successful organization or anything like that. It's that Toronto is in Canada. That is a geography lesson that probably didn't need to be shared, but it is. Toronto is in Canada, and so if we are playing an American-based team, the only half of the teams involved in said game draw from a local U.S. market. You would expect when Golden State plays Milwaukee, there will be eyeballs across the country, but they will draw big numbers in the San Francisco Bay Area and big numbers in Wisconsin, right? And then outside of that, people are diving in and out if they're a fan of the team or not, but, you know, you get the national eyeballs. Toronto is a market would offer potentially hundreds of thousands and maybe a million plus eyeballs on a Christmas day, but that doesn't matter to TNT. That's just the truth. That's all it is. It's not a, we hate you.
Yeah. It's not a slight on the team. Just everyone needs to relax up here. it's not
at Mike Zigomanis on Twitter. If you don't feel like relaxing. DMs are always open.
Yeah, DMs are always open. I don't see it. I'm not offended if the Raps don't get the love and the respect of playing on Christmas Day, even when, you know, they're one of the best teams in the league and they deserve to be playing on Christmas Day. It just has to be. It's all about the fact that we're in Canada. Sorry.
Well, I know I'm speaking purely from my point of view. And that it is not the same for everybody. So I respect that. But like Christmas Day is a really busy day. I don't know how you find it. For some people, it's awfully quiet. So, you know, these games can keep people company or what have you. But like, I'm fortunate enough that it's a really busy day. So then I'm not feeling like my attention needs to be divided or I've got to check Twitter for score updates or that I've got to go home later that night and work off. A bit of an alcohol coma and too much turkey while I'm watching a game on PVR.
It's almost like the football games on Thanksgiving in the U.S. It's such an important and, do you know what I mean? It's such a big day for them. They love their, like, football on Thanksgiving is such a big event in the U.S. and the Thanksgiving and the Christmas basketball, they're such important days for sports. We don't have that in Canada. Like what game do the Raptors and Leafs play on a certain day where it's like, okay, this is such a tradition and we're so used to it.
Right.
Like the Leafs, they don't play on, St. Paddy's Day. Like, decent one?
I'll give you two examples, Siggy. The two, and you know, the Argos are continue to fight for relevance in this market. I'll give you two, though. One is the Argos Labor Day game in Hamilton.
Fine. Yeah.
And the other one is the Blue Jays home game on Canada Day, where they wear their red shirts and that's it.
But those are the two biggest, but they don't come close to like basketball and Christmas or football and Thanksgiving in the U.S. Right. I'm talking people set their days around for those games. I have a hard time believing majority of sports fans in Canada or Toronto set their schedule around those two dates. I'm sure there are fans out there. I'm not taking this away from them, the hardcore fans. I'm just, even for the casual fans, I feel like people that don't watch football at all, it's like, well, I'm watching football and it's turkey. It's Thanksgiving. But they're not football fans.
Tony from Stony Creek. I went to last year's Christmas Day game with my son. And as a lifetime Raptors fan, I can honestly say they didn't deserve a game this year because they pooped the bed last year against the Celtics. I really just read that text, Ziggy, because I wanted to get poop the bed into the show. That is a good line. We will no longer poop the bed. We're stepping our game up here. It was 25 years ago tonight, and any hockey fan who was alive at the time and is old enough to remember this recalls it well. Patrick Waugh was left in a game between the Red Wings and the Montreal Canadiens for 9 goals against. Detroit would go on to win the hockey game 11-1, but it was what happened when Waugh was pulled from the game. The stare down with the then head coach Mario Tremblay and Waugh going to the end of the bench, leaning over into the stands. There was no plexiglass separating the first row from the bench at the time, leaning over and saying to then Habs president Ronald Corey, "I'm done in Montreal." And the Habs franchise, you could argue, they've had some good years, but has not been the same since. Brian Savage played in the NHL from 1993 to 2006, and he was with the Habs for a good chunk of his career, and he was there that night. He joins us to relive the night and the lead up to it. Brian, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, guys. Great.
Can you believe it's been 25 years? I mean, that for all you accomplished on the ice, this didn't involve you directly other than it affected your team. But it I would imagine it would be a moment that you would have reflected on a number of times over the last quarter century.
Well, there's definitely many times I used to sit beside Patrick in the locker room. So I got firsthand sight of what happened after the game, but also what led up to it and basically what happened for this thing to happen this way.
A lot of people, you know, all they can remember is, you know, it was a blowout game, and that's the first thing. And the second thing, and we were talking about earlier in the show, is that Patrick walked back and forth on the bench, and there's a couple different stories on exactly what was said. Were you sitting on the bench when that happened, did you hear everything?
Yes, I was on the bench. Yeah, he got what happened was probably a couple of weeks before we had a game in Buffalo on a Friday night. And the history of Patrick and Mario goes back to when they were roommates, when they were teammates back in the day. And when Mario and Rajon took over as GM, Mario's first game was against Toronto, and Patrick was talking about some stories before the game and this and that. We were laughing, and anyways, Mario came in the dressing room and doing his pregame speech, and Patrick started giggling a little bit during his speech. And so, Mario stopped and said, "Hey, Patrick, what's going on?" "Nothing," and kept going on with the speech. Next thing you know, Patrick starts giggling again. And so Mario sort of went off on him a little bit. Anyways, we ended up going out, beating Toronto in that first game, and things were rolling smooth until we got to Buffalo about 2 weeks before this Detroit game. And when Patrick was goalie under Jacques Demers, he used to decide when he would sit out and when he would play. And so we were in Buffalo, and Mario came in to do a speech, and he said, "Hey, Patrick Lonsky, you're in tonight, and Patrick Waugh, you're going to be in Saturday night back home." And Patty's like, "Oh, no, don't worry, I'm good tonight, too." So they went out for warm-up, and Patrick Lonsky's like, what do I do here? And he said, "Don't worry about this kid, I got it." And so he went in the warm-up. There's Patrick Waugh in the net. Mario's on the bench, his head's just fuming. Come back in the dress room, go out for the game, and Mario goes, "Pat Jablonski, you're in tonight," and left the room. So here's Jablonski all flustered, and here's Patrick Waugh, who's going to be a Hall of Famer and this and that. And he goes, "Don't worry, kid, I got this," goes out. Anyways, we end up winning the game, go back to Montreal the following day, win that game. But that's in the back of Mario's mind now. As you can imagine, a couple of weeks later, we're playing Detroit. You know, Patty doesn't have one of his better games. I think it's, we're down 6-1 or 6-0 after two, thinking that Mario's going to pull him, puts him back in. They score another one, and they score another one. The famous hands of Patrick Waugh going up. And that's when they finally pulled him, and that's when he was obviously furious and walked behind us on the bench, dropped his stuff at the end, walked back to Ronald Corey and say, "That's my last game in Montreal." After the game, we went back obviously in the dressing room. Patty probably undressed in 2 minutes and left the building, and that was the last we've seen of him.
with Brian Savage, former Montreal Canadian. It was 25 years ago tonight that Patrick Roy played his last game for the Montreal Canadiens. So you said you were next to him. Your locker stall was next to Patrick. So would you describe him, Brian, as a buddy of yours? Were you good friends? And the reason I ask is, obviously, you in hindsight, you're sensing a buildup, a couple of incidents in previous games. Did you know that something was up? And had you gone out and beat Detroit 3-2 that night, and Patty hadn't got shelled at all the rest of the season, such that a situation like that night wouldn't have been created, was there a chance he never would have gotten traded? Or would there have been a blow up eventually because the two just didn't get along?
I'm not sure what would have happened. Patty was such a competitive player. He competed in practice and confronted people if they weren't competing and so forth. I'm not sure what would have happened. You know, I just know that they really haven't recovered since that trade. And you know, Rajon Wu is such a good guy. You know, you put that on him as his first trade ever as a GM. He's got to trade Patrick Roy. And, you know, everybody's coming after him, vultures from all around the league, you know, trying to make a terrible deal with him. But, you know, it was a tough situation for all.
Do you remember in the few days between the incident on December the 2nd and the trade, hearing any rumors about where Patrick may be going? I'm fascinated, Brian, by this deal because, you know, the Colorado Avalanche were the Quebec Nordique the year before. There's no way that trade happens with that franchise if it's still in Quebec. That wouldn't have been possible, right?
Yeah, I think Rajon may have had relationships with the GM. I forget what his name was.
Pierre Lacroix?
Pierre Lacroix. He was a French-Canadian, obviously, from Quebec. And that may have had something to do with it, but I'm not sure.
What was, you know, we were talking a little bit about the history between Tremblay and Roy. Was there any... What was the story behind the cafe or the bar where they were there both in? Is there any way you could, you know, dig into the details of that? Because I've asked around. I haven't heard much about the issue they had at, you know, having a drink somewhere or at some cafe. And then in practice, Tremblay apparently fired a puck at Roy.
Yeah, I don't know that story. That's news to me. I don't know if it happened or not. Over the last 25 years, it might have blown up to something else, but I don't remember any incident that they were at a bar or, you know, started a fight or anything like that.
What do you remember about your reaction and the team's reaction to the trade? Not just that, I mean, you knew he was getting moved out of town, but in terms of what you got in return, and how did that change the dynamic and mood of the team the rest of the way in the 95-96 season?
Well, we got back Thibault. We got back Martin Rosinski, and it was Kovalev or
Andre Kovalenko. Yep, Kovalenko.
So, you know, first of all, for Thibault to come back and replace his childhood idol in Patrick Roy as another French-Canadian goalie, that's a tough situation to be in. You know, he did the best he could, but the pressure obviously was immense on him to do so. I just remember my reaction was, okay, we traded Patrick Roy, but we also threw in Mike Keane in the deal, who was our acting captain at that time, and who was a hell of a player, a great guy in the locker room. And so that was a little surprise also that he was thrown in the deal. And then I think everybody was in shock. Obviously, here's a player that did so much for the Canadiens over his time that was there, and one of the best goalies in the league at the time. You know, it was a tough, I think it took about 3 or 4 days to get the deal done too.
Yeah, that was a surprise for me when I see that name part of the trade. Was he or anybody else, any of the other leadership group, did they go in to kind of see, you know, hey, with management or the coaching staff, like, you guys have to figure this out. Like, were certain players backing Waugh or Tremblay? Like, how did that all go down? Because trading Mike Keane was a head scratcher for me.
Mm-hmm. I think we were all just in awe of what was happening. I can say for myself that, you know, management would go to Patrick and try to get him, to come back and, just sit down with him and see if they could work things out and he'd be back and, you know, the apology and this and that. But after 2 or 3 days, we didn't hear from Patrick at all. He was a ghost for those days. And then obviously maybe Patrick and the GM from Colorado had a relationship, maybe. Because I think he was an agent before, right? I'm not sure if he was Patty's agent before or not. And that's sort of what happened.
Brian, before we get you out of here, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you what you're up to these days. How are you enjoying life? What's up?
Well, I'm trying to do the best we can during these circumstances. I live just outside of Detroit. I've got 3 boys. One's at Miami University of Ohio. Actually, he's going to play his first game today in a bubble.
So he's following in your footsteps, Omaha. Right? You went to Miami.
Yeah.
That's neat.
I've got a second son, Redmond, who plays on the USA development team here in Detroit. He'll be heading to Miami next year. And then I have a younger son, Rory, who was a minor bantam who plays for CompuWare here. And I'm just enjoying watching them trying to get through this pandemic as best we can.
Well, we thank you for getting up this morning and sharing your memories of a historic day. Anybody who remembers hockey from that time remembers the last night that Patrick Waugh played for the Habs. We appreciate it, Brian, and we'll look to catch up again. Thank you so much.
All right, guys. Have a great day.
Brian Savage, who played for the Montreal Canadiens from 93-94 to 01-02, and he was out of the league after the 05-06 season. I wonder, too, on the Keane thing, Ziggy, just to jump in.
There's got to be something there.
You know, there might be, but what about Colorado saying, hey, like Mike Keane, kind of a leadership type that we throw him in with the Sakics and the Forsbergs of the world. He can be a third line winger. Colorado, we're getting a goaltender here. We're now a legit Stanley Cup contender. We get a leadership guy like Mike Keane to play in our bottom six. It's a nice little ad for us.
Yeah.
He might have come from the other side too, no?
I think there's more to that from the Canadian side in the fact that I think Mike Keane had said something and somebody was not happy with a situation with him and the team. How can you trade your captain mid-season? Unless you make some big change, I don't get it. Obviously, okay, trading Waugh is a big change, but trading your captain and Mike Keane and what he means to your, the Canadians at that time, I don't know. I think there's more there. And if guys in the room didn't know, I mean, is anybody going to know? I doubt Mike Keane would. We got to get him on.
Think back to the think back to Brian Savage saying that Waugh ghosted everybody for 2 or 3 days. That would have been easier back then because you had landlines. You know, maybe Patrick Waugh had one of those big clanky ass cell phones that were out at that point and that you'd charge in the car in between the drivers and passenger seats. But yeah, there was
the size of your shoe.
There was no texting. There was no.
The gray phone.
Yeah.
The big gray phone. It's like a water bottle.
Yeah. Can't carry that one around in your pocket.
Yeah. Landlines. Or yeah, you just go no. You know what you do? You go no voicemail. Let me tell you something. You want to change your life? Go no voicemail. You can ghost whoever you want. I didn't get the call.
Ziggy, call me after the show and see what you get. Some of us are ahead of that game. Oops, I didn't set up my voicemail. I guess that means you'll have to text me. It means I don't have to dial up, punch in my password, and listen to 45 seconds of, so if you could just, like, call me back, just text me and say, where are you? I need to talk to you. That's all I need from people. I am one of those. I do not have my voicemail set up. I'm one of those people.
So you are one of them.
I am one of them. It's a control mechanism.
Yeah, it literally is life-changing, but yeah, no, you're ahead of me on the no voicemail.
Okay, well, gas yours and we'll discuss. Dan Shulman, the winner, announced yesterday of the Jack Graney Award. He is going in to the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. We'll talk about that, and we'll discuss the state of the Blue Jays this offseason. They're linked to a lot of names. Heady times, exciting times. Dan Shulman next.
You're listening to Lead Off with Ziggy and Scotty Mack on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Catherine Tappan will join us at the top of the 8 o'clock hour. She's from the NHL on NBC and had the opportunity on Sunday night to work the sidelines of Sunday Night Football. Adnan Virk, our good buddy, who's with us each and every week from the GM Shuffle podcast, the MLB Network, the NHL Network at 8:30. And one of the things we'll talk about with Adnan, Ziggy, is the report by his co-host, or not the report, the opinion piece written by his co-host on the GM Shuffle podcast, Michael Lombardi, that Bruce Arians and Tom Brady are oil and water. Oil and water. It's not working out between the two in Tampa Bay.
I'm not surprised at all. I feel like I've stated this prior to the season. I don't want to say that I knew this would happen. I had the feeling that it's not so much the two of them. It had more to do my original thoughts on Brady and the Bucks. I thought that the transition to him, you know, kind of controlling that offense, there would be a lot of struggles. The fact that they're butting heads and seeing what Arians has been saying in the media, that I'm surprised he went there, and that can cause a lot of problems.
We'll get into that about an hour from now with Adnan Virk. Now, and it's funny, we had him on about a month ago when Dan Shulman was nominated as one of the finalists for the Ford C. Frick Award. So that is the award handed out each year to a broadcaster, which garners them entry into the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. Well, Dan has been announced as the winner this year of the Jack Graney Award, and Dan will take his rightful place in the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame down the road in St. Mary's, Ontario, as part of the 2021 class. And he takes some time to join us now. Mr. Shulman, congratulations yet again. And I may have tweeted this yesterday, and in case you missed it, I'm going to bring it up again. Clearly, the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame does not discriminate based on one's NFL preference.
I actually did see that.
Because that should have been held against you.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I saw a rash also.
Go Vikings.
Something out and just go Vikings or something like that. Maturity is overrated. It's good we can act like that as long as we want. But I appreciate it. I'm very honored about this one. And you know, when you look at Dave Van Horn, Tom Cheek, Jerry Howarth, Bob Elliott, Jeff Blair, Richard Griffin, you know, a lot of people that I know and worked with and admired, you know, I mean, beginning with Tom, first and foremost. So I'm very honored to have gotten this. Thank you.
So how do you get notified? Does somebody call you? Do you get, you know, does a letter come in the mail? How does this all, I'm curious how, you know, it all goes down.
So I got a call actually from Scott Crawford, who's the director of operations, I think is his title, of the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. And it was on Friday. So he said, he called and I saw his name on my phone. I know Scott, but the occasional work email or something like that. So as soon as I saw his name, I started wondering, but I didn't know again that it was announcement time of the year or anything like that. And we just chit-chatted for a couple of minutes. You know, he asked me how my family is. He knows my wife a little bit. And, you know, how you make it out through the pandemic. And then eventually he said, well, I've got some good news for you. And he told me. So it was nice. I was just sitting there doing some college basketball prep, sitting on the couch with my laptop when he told me. And then he said, he goes, now I've got to ask you a favor. And I said, what? He goes, please don't tell anybody. We want to make sure that the announcement, you know, comes from us on Tuesday. So I promised him, and I kind of kept my word. And the two people or three people I told, I guess, you know, all kept the secret between Friday and Tuesday.
With Dan Shulman, who's going into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame in the 2021 class, the winner announced yesterday of the Jack Graney Award. So Dan, I mean, you can do a lot of things in life simply by being you. And one of the things that you do is you call baseball games for a living. But how would you describe your advocacy for Canadian baseball, both within our country and in the United States? I mean, you are an ambassador.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I'm very, you know, as you know, I'm very proud of being Canadian, and I've worked probably more in the U.S. in my career than I have in Canada, but I've always lived in Canada. And, you know, on a grassroots level, had the great pleasure of coaching one of my sons in rep baseball for about 7 years and traveled all around Ontario playing in tournaments and stuff like that. And I am proud of it. I like both on the baseball and the basketball front that people know I'm Canadian, or I like seeing their reaction in the U.S. when they find out I'm Canadian, even if they've known, you know, who I am for many years through one sport or another. So, I mean, I think it shows that you can come from anywhere and do anything. You know, you don't have to be born in the country that, you know, baseball was invented in and grew up in order to call games. I think there are a lot of talented Canadian players, Canadian broadcasters, Canadian writers, Canadian, you know, builders of the game. And if I can be, you know, a very, very small part of that group, then I think that's great. And I'll be honest with you, yesterday, I didn't know what, you know, we're in a social media world, right? I had no idea what kind of traction this would get. And the reaction I got from people south of the border was, you know, I kind of expected it from people in Canada, but the reaction I got from people south of the border blew me away. And it was really nice to hear from a lot of people about this. I will tell you, if I can, this is kind of the humble brag thing. So I had this person's phone number because I had him on my podcast. And he said, yeah, you just call me and we'll do it this way. So I had his phone number. So he had my phone number. But Larry Walker texted me yesterday to congratulate me. And with all due respect to, like, all of my family members, that's probably the coolest text I've ever gotten in my life. That's when I kind of sat down and went, wow, a Hall of Famer just texted me about this. That was cool.
Yeah. Oh, Larry Walker. I mean, that is awesome.
Right?
That is awesome.
Yeah.
And you're reminded, Dan, that everybody's heard of you in moments like that, right? Because Larry Walker is sitting down to watch Sunday Night Baseball for all those years. Or if he's up in Canada, he's throwing a game on Sportsnet and catching a few innings of a Blue Jays game every now and then. And you're calling those games. It's really neat.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, fire away, because I was going to change topics.
I was just going to say, like, I've never, and you know me well enough, I think, to know I don't think of it that way. Like, I'm literally this is go to work, do the game. You know, like, this is, and then, you know, wash, rinse, repeat. This is what I do. So that was one that really, you know, kind of took me aback. But I just want to thank everybody at the hall, the committee, you know, that nominated me. And COVID permitting, hopefully we'll have a ceremony. I don't know if you've ever been there for induction weekend in June. It's in June, I think, in St. Mary's. And it's they're great people. They really are. And hopefully the world will allow us to get together at some point.
Well, it's a wonderful honor. And you know, this so well deserved. And we congratulate you. We would be remiss, and I'll probably take a shot at the Packers a little bit later on before we let you go. I mean, I have to. I've got a quota, Dan. Two every morning. And with you here, I'm going to use both on you. But Blue Jays news. Like, they're linked to this guy, that guy, and the other guy. I am anticipating and feeling good about something exciting happening here. And whether it's Springer, perhaps less likely LeMahieu, or the alternative to that, a Colton Wong, who's a plus defender, not necessarily plus with the bat, but a guy who would fit in nicely. Vladdy's 40 pounds lighter and wants to play third base in Dominican winter ball. Like, we're sitting here on December the 2nd, so we're 3 months away from anything consequential and 4 months away from a game that matters, but it feels generally like this organization is in a pretty good place.
I agree 100%. There are only good things happening right now, and I also agree with what you said. It could be Springer. It could be LeMahieu. I think it's more likely Springer than LeMahieu. I don't know if it's likely either one of them comes, but if it's not one of those, you know, top-shelf free agents, they're going to get somebody. Maybe it's Colton Wong. Maybe it's Ha-Sung Kim, the Korean shortstop, who can play all over the infield. Maybe it's Jackie Bradley Jr. They're going to get another starting pitcher. They're going to be a better team April 1st than they are December 2nd or whatever it is. They should be healthier than they were last year, and the kids all have a year more of experience. Like, everything, you know, the arrow is pointing up in a bunch of respects. And not for nothing, you know, Charlie Morton's not back with the Rays, and they might trade Blake Snell. And those are not inconsequential things for a team that resides in the American League East. So I think there are a lot of good things, and we could talk for an hour about the puzzle that the Blue Jays have. Do they let Vladdy have another shot at third base? How much do they believe in Rowdy Tellez? If they get Wong, what do they do with Biggio? Is there a chance they trade Gurriel if Springer signs? You know, it's a very intricate, complicated puzzle. And the good thing about it is it's not like there's one guy on the market where the Blue Jays say, that's the guy we have to get. If they don't get that guy, they can get another guy who maybe isn't as good, but my point is there are many different ways they can make themselves better. It's not just one path. They have a number of paths, a number of options to make themselves better. And that's, to me, that's pretty exciting.
Well, and you talk about Morton being out of Tampa Bay and the possibility of the Rays trading Snell. What about the New York Yankees starting staff not named Gerrit Cole? Like, yeah. I that doesn't mean the Yankees can't address it, because goodness knows the Yankees have the cash to do it and the wherewithal. But, like, you almost sense it's not just that the Jays are on the upswing, but that this division is available to be attacked if you're going to be and willing to be aggressive enough.
Yeah, and the core is very cheap right now. It'll get more expensive next year, more expensive the year after, more expensive the year after. And plus, we haven't mentioned the Red Sox. Like, the Red Sox are legitimately down right now. The Yankees have some holes to fill, but they're still the Yankees. But I think the time to pounce is now. I know they may not be, quote, ready to win just yet. That might take another year or two, but I don't think that means you don't pounce right now. Plus, it's a buyer's market. It looks like it'll be a buyer's market, given the economic climate. And the Blue Jays may be one of four or five teams who actually have some money that they can throw around a little bit. Like, to me, there are so many reasons to jump in now and to make yourself as good as you can now, even if the ultimate, you know, best season that they're going to have might still be 2-3 years away. So there are a lot of good things. And I know everybody's focused on the big name free agents, and that's great, but there's a chance they'll add two or three pretty good guys who are still going to make them better. You know, they had some obvious holes last year. We know where they are. And I think they'll get better. They'll get another starting pitcher. The defense has to be better. It just has to be. For them to be a good team, they've got to improve defensively. So even if they go out and get like a Colton Wong, I don't know if they move Biggio to third or if Vladdy's back at third and Biggio like plays 6 days a week, but all over the place. Like, these are all good possibilities and good things to consider. And wouldn't you love to be a fly on the wall and listen to these conversations this winter with everything that's flying around?
So the Rogers Center, home of the Blue Jays, looks like it's going to be moved, or they're going to renovate, do something with where the park is currently, where it's currently at. What was your first thought when the news broke?
I'll be honest with you. I was happy. And, you know, Rogers Center, and Scott obviously had a connection with your father. So Rogers Center, when it was built, 1989, was the eighth wonder of the world. It was wondrous. It was perfect. It was what got free agents to Toronto. It helped deliver a world championship, two World Series championships to Toronto. There's no disputing that. I think it's also fair to say that over time, as we saw other cities get ballparks, baseball-only ballparks, smaller, intimate, that things changed. And the Rogers Center, or SkyDome at the time, was kind of the last of the big multi-purpose facilities. And now everybody wants a little, you know, beautiful ballpark. So, and I think it's time. You know, Texas and Atlanta have gotten two since we got one. So my reaction was, this is great. This sounds real, like it might happen. In terms of where it is, how long it takes, it's all very complicated, multiple layers of government, who owns the land, and that stuff, you know, way beyond my reach. I don't understand a lot of who owns what and how that stuff has to work. But I do know this. I think, you know, a 38 to 42,000 retractable roof baseball facility of a ballpark in downtown Toronto would be a great thing for this city and the fan base. And, you know, no public funding sounds great, too, given the world we live in right now. I hope it happens, and I hope it does happen in the next 3 to 5 years, that we're not talking about an 8 to 10 year kind of process. The other thing is, it's going to be disruptive to a certain extent, but, you know, they can't need somewhere to play for 5 years. It doesn't work that way. If you're building right on the site where the current ballpark is, you got to find somewhere to play for a couple of years. And even that, to me, feels untenable. You can't send this, you don't want Bo and Vladdy in their core playing in Montreal or Buffalo or wherever it is. So my guess is the ballpark is built not exactly where the Rogers Center is, whether it's across the street or whether it's at, further east where there's some room. I don't know. But I do hope it happens, and I hope it happens as soon as possible.
Great to chat this morning, Dan. The road to Cooperstown stops in St. Mary's for you. So congratulations, it's a wonderful honor, and you deserve it.
Thank you, and go Pack, go.
Who? Sorry, what? My headphones cut out there. I just want you to know we'll be back in 2021, and we are scheduled to play again next year, so I'm looking forward to that. Okay?
Okay. Well, I'm much nicer about your team than you are about mine. And I've got a witness in Ziggy.
who's worse? Who's worse to you, a rash or me? It's got to be a rash.
Is that how low you want to set the bar, Scotty?
Yes.
Really? Is that
way? I want to be nicer than someone.
You're marginally nicer than a rash, Danny. That can be on your Hall of Fame plaque. He was marginally nicer than a rash, Danny.
There you go. Good to hear your voice, pal. Thank you.
Thanks.
Dan Shulman, the voice of the Blue Jays here on Sportsnet, and the winner of the Jack Graney Award. He's going into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame class of 2021. Meanwhile, we're cleaning out our prize closet with the help of Jiffy. We've made mystery boxes, which contain signed jerseys and more, for you to win. To enter, you need to listen during Good Show, Writer's Block, and Tim and Sid every weekday to collect keywords. Then you text them to 590-590 and include your first name, your last name, and your city. Then you tune in every morning at this time to lead off for your chance to qualify. So we're about to tell you who we drew from all of the entries we got yesterday. If you hear your name, you've got 590 seconds to call us back, and you'll immediately win $100 to spend at Jiffy, and you will qualify for this week's mystery box, which we will open on the air at 7:30 on Monday, and we will announce the winner for that mystery box at that time as well. So this morning, we've drawn the name Wayne Simpson from Mississauga. Wayne Simpson from Mississauga, your 590 seconds starts now. 416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, or *590 on your cell. Everyone else, you stay tuned for the next keyword during Good Show after 9 a.m., and you can check out sportsnet.ca/590 for contest details. Something to chew on. Would we spend money on Tyson Holyfield in 2021? We'll discuss next. Silent Vic just wanted to throw out a happy 42nd to Nelly Furtado.
Canadian songstress.
That's right, Canadian, man. I keep forgetting that.
Remember she did a lot of stuff with Timbaland?
Yes.
It was Timbaland, right? Vic? Okay, there we go. You got the thumbs up, okay. Yeah.
Vic told you
things
that.
Things I thought I'd never hear you and Scott ever say. Hugh or Scott.
I just went, yes.
Neither of you would ever say.
And I'm sitting there going, definitely silent Vic told Hugh that in the commercial break before Hugh came in.
Ziggy, you should have seen, or maybe you did, the look on Scotty Mac's face when I said that. He's like, what? His eyes got as big as saucers.
Remember when she did some stuff with Timbaland? Yes. Yes,
who,
I do.
Who doesn't, really?
All right. Who's throwing money down if Tyson fights Holyfield?
This is interesting.
Hands up. You have to speak on the radio.
I will.
Oh, sorry. No hands up.
Hey, you know what? I bought Tyson Roy Jones Jr.
I know you did.
I am definitely buying Tyson Holyfield because of the possibility that it could turn into a real fight.
Yeah, Holyfield's
58. Tyson's 54?
54.
Well, yeah, I mean, the first two went to Holyfield, right?
Back when they were in their prime.
Holyfield's still going to be in great shape, though. Like, he's always in great shape. In fact, I think a couple of years ago, he was making noise about actually getting in the ring again to fight. Ziggy, would you pay for that?
No, I'm going to pay for it. I don't know. Like, I want it to get real. I want them to start really throwing. But, I mean, do you think they could make it through more than three or four rounds if they actually started throwing? I don't know. I don't think it would last that long.
No. So did you hear Tyson's comments after the Roy Jones Jr. fight? He said he wasn't used to the two-minute rounds. Like, he would only just be getting into his groove and the round would be over. So it'd be interesting to see Tyson Holyfield maybe fight six rounds, but 3-minute rounds. We'll see.
Here's what I know. If you both order it, one of you can invite me over. I'll bring the popcorn.
Sure.
I ain't paying a cent.
There's no way you would come all the way up to Scarborough to watch that fight.
I ain't paying.
And there's no way you're getting past security in my building. Not with that hair.
Put my name on the list. Speak to the concierge. Adnan Virk at 8:30. We're looking forward to our conversation at the top of the hour. The great Catherine Tappan of the NHL on NBC, and she worked the sidelines of Sunday Night Football this past week. Catherine Tappan next. Coming up in about a half an hour for his weekly Wednesday visit, and we'll discuss the piece written by his co-host on the GM Shuffle podcast, Michael Lombardi, suggesting that the Brady-Arians relationship down there in Tampa Bay just is not going according to plan.
Well, not.
They do have a winning record. They should make the playoffs. I mean,
I don't think many people are shocked. If this was going to go south, this is something you would have expected that there would be. You hear all the rumblings. Let me tell you, winning solves a lot of problems. You can have the biggest beefs with guys in the room, coaching staff. When you win, it's all gone. You can't say anything. Media can't say anything. You know that, Scotty.
I know. The other thing is, and I say this as a 41-year-old, Tom Brady's 43. At some point, and I can attest, it starts to catch up to you. So Adnan Virk in about 25 minutes. We've been looking forward to this conversation. From the NHL on NBC, and on Sunday night in beautiful Green Bay, Wisconsin, she worked the sidelines for Sunday Night Football, the Bears-Packers matchup. We welcome to the program Catherine Tappan. Catherine, good morning. How are you?
Hi. Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on.
It's wonderful to have you on. So let's start with the experience. I would imagine that we've all had them, if we work in this industry, some wow moments. The opportunity not just to work Sunday Night Football, but to do so at Lambeau Field must have been a real cool moment in your career.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. It's funny because I just remember in college, I mean, I wanted to do this my whole life, what I'm doing. I'm just blessed to be living my dream job. But I remember in college watching Sunday Night Football and just thinking, like, that's where I got to be. You know, I mean, it's the biggest show in television, in all of television, news, entertainment, sports, you name it. And all eyeballs are on there on Sunday night. And then you're right, to be at Lambeau. I mean, it's interesting because I've covered plenty of football games before. I was a beat reporter for the Patriots for years when I worked at NESN. And I, you know, I've covered a couple Super Bowls for NBC doing pregame and postgame interviews, but never during the game and on the sidelines. And so being at Lambeau, it was a little bit surreal. I'd been there before for Football Night in America. And, you know, Lambeau, especially Bears Packers, forget it. It's the coolest atmosphere in the world. You know, the surrounding areas around Lambeau is really unique because all the neighborhoods come together and people, you know, sell $10 to park your car on their lawn, and they pack their lawn and they get money for that, and that pays their property taxes throughout the year. So it's a really neat environment when you're driving into Lambeau. It not only looks cool, it smells cool. I mean, you smell all the brats cooking on the grills, and it's just an experience. Sunday was weird. I mean, they said they were allowing 500 fans. I'd be shocked if there were 50 fans in there. And it was just, it just felt so different. I mean, it's a sign of the times, obviously, but a very different, unique way to cover the game for sure. But the actual, I mean, once that ball was kicked and the opening kickoff, I mean, it's a game, but it was definitely a different experience being at Lambeau in those conditions.
Where would you rank that for events that you've gotten to cover, you know, NHL, Olympics, college football?
Yeah, I mean, it's at the top. There's nothing like it. It's like I said before. I mean, it's almost, you know, it's almost weird to think I even did it looking back. And I know the week, I'd say like 2 weeks beforehand, I was really nervous. And then once I started to put my preparation in, and you guys know this, I mean, then it just becomes, okay, you're putting in the right wheels in motion. You've got your preparation. You've talked to the players. I've done everything I need to do, everything I usually do for a college football game. I'm doing it right now. So it's kind of the nerves went down, and then it became more excitement. And I really had time on Sunday. I was laughing because I'm like, this is such a long day to wait for kickoff. Like, I wanted to kick off at 8 a.m. I was ready to go. But you know, I had time to reflect. You know, we were in these hotel rooms. We can't do what we usually do on the road, gather with our, you know, teammates and have breakfast together or have meetings together and dinners together. I mean, you're isolated when you're on the road right now. And so I had a lot of time to think. I called my little godchildren to try and like distract me and talk to them. And, you know, they're 5 and 3 and they were just so funny and could care less what I was doing that night. So they just wanted to talk to me, which really those things kind of help calm your nerves, but it's at the top of what I've done. I mean, I always wanted to cover an Olympics, and I was about to go into my fourth one this year in Tokyo. And I would say the Olympics are really, I mean, that's a career defining assignment. And, you know, you can only do it on NBC. So the fact that I work for NBC and I've had the opportunity to do the Olympics was huge for me in years past. And now to add Sunday Night Football sidelines to the list of opportunities, it's definitely at the top for sure.
With Catherine Tappan of NBC Sports on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm interested, Catherine, in preparation for the Olympics, because, I mean, I think we would all acknowledge that a lot of Olympic sports are sports with which we're not entirely familiar. So you're almost going in, you know, as a baby and growing with the program, talking to the athletes, talking to the coaches, et cetera, et cetera. How did you prepare for the three Olympics you've been able to cover so far?
Yeah, it's really, the Olympics are, like you said, it's different in the sense that you don't know these athletes every day. I mean, we're used to hearing, you know, household names in the NHL and the NFL and Major League Baseball in North America. We hear them all the time, and we watch, you know, there's a million different sports programs on TV every day that you can catch up on sports. So with the Olympics, it's a matter of staying current, you know, once the teams are set. So you can prepare all you want in years in advance, which I stay current by following a lot of athletes on Instagram. You know, I follow Michaela Schifrin. I'm following Kerry Walsh Jennings. I'm following a lot of the athletes that we know are likely going to be there. But it's the unknowns. It's the ones that qualify at the last minute, you know, and then 2 weeks later, boom, they're competing at the Olympics, which those are the ones that you really, it's a crash course. So luckily the Olympics I've covered, there have been very long flights to get there. 'Cause we get a research packet that is, I mean, carrying this thing to Sochi, it was like, I mean, people were making fun of me on the plane. I remember I was on Team USA's hockey team flight going over to Sochi, and I had this massive binder, you guys. It was like 6 inches thick, and it weighed a ton, and I'm trying to go through all these sports, and, you know, it didn't even fit in my backpack. I looked like I was, you know, studying, I don't even know what, but it was, you know, that's what you have to do, and you've got to cram. It's almost like it's studying for a test at the last minute, because a lot of these athletes, you don't know who they are until you get there. Hockey was really challenging in South Korea because we didn't have NHL players. So, I mean, I remember, first of all, pronouncing the names of half the players that were there was difficult. And then, you know, not knowing their tendencies. It's very easy for us to be able to broadcast, you know, NHL guys that are playing in the Olympics because we see them every night. So that was definitely a quick learning curve, a steep learning curve. But you go to the practices, you go to the availability that they allow you to. When I did beach volleyball in Rio, I got there about a week early. So got to do my research on Copacabana Beach every morning. It was not a terrible assignment.
That's but nice.
It was, you know, you stand by the fences. They give you a little bit of time with each athlete, you know, in the morning right after their practices. And you just ask personal stories. And for me, that's a big thing, is learning them. I don't need to know, you know, my analyst is going to tell you all the analyticals of what they're doing right or wrong on the, you know, on the sand, but I need to know more about their story and their background, because that's why people tune into the Olympics. They want to know the stories of these athletes. So you really, what I find rewarding though, is that they're so willing to talk to you. You know, it's very different when you cover professional sports. Some days somebody might not want to talk to you and you just have to accept that. But Olympic athletes, for the most part, this is their moment to shine. And it may be the first and last time they have an opportunity to do that. So they're very willing to open up to you and share their story. They know mom and dad and cousins and aunts and uncles back home are going to be watching. So that is refreshing when, you know, you have somebody that really wants to share those details with you.
So big milestone day in the U.S. and in Canada, all female crews covering the Flames and Knights and Blues and Blackhawks. When do you think this is not going to be, I guess, headline news? When will we see more women covering sports?
Well, I think we are not there yet. I love that we had that day, but I hated that it was a day. And, you know, it was nice to get the attention. I'm glad everybody received the attention they deserve, because every single one of us, from on camera to behind the scenes, this is what we do for a living. This isn't like, hey, NBC called, you know, some random person from the street to say, do you want to broadcast the hockey? I mean, this is what we do every single day. So to bring us all together on one broadcast was really neat. But these are, you know, everybody puts in hard work to do their jobs. So I don't think we're there yet. You know, I think that there's still a steep divide. I think that this pandemic probably didn't help either. So I'm hoping that just women's sports in general, I mean, that from the athletes to the broadcasters to women working for the teams, I hope it continues to trend upwards. Unfortunately, a lot of people have lost their jobs over the last year, and a lot of people, you know, a lot of companies have reduced their footprint of production teams and people covering sports and broadcasting sports. So I'm hoping that doesn't affect where we were headed, because I thought we were going in a very good direction. But we're not quite where we need to be. And, you know, it's also a matter of male or female. You have to be able to do the job. And I don't think anybody should be rewarded just for the color of their skin or their gender or whatever they might be. I mean, you've got to earn it. And, you know, you've got to pay your dues and do it the hard way. I mean, I can think of times back in Providence, Rhode Island, working for a local TV where it was a struggle. There were so many things I didn't know how to do. And there's still things I don't get right that I've got to work on. So that hard work, though, pays off. I mean, you don't get to Sunday Night Football just getting there because I'm a female and they just needed that, you know, quota for the night. And so I encourage that more than anything else. And I think the more women put in the work to do it, then we're going to start seeing a lot more women, because they're qualified. I mean, look at Kendall Coyne Schofield, just got that incredible job with the Blackhawks, and Kenny Granato is working for Seattle, and because they are qualified individuals that know their stuff. So it comes down to that. And I think the more and more women that feel confident by seeing someone like Kenny or seeing someone like Kendall, or if they see me and want to do what I do, great. Then they know they can, if they see it, they can believe it and they can do it. And that's the biggest thing.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a wonderful now retired Canadian hockey player here. You would know well, Catherine Haley-Wickenheiser, who's Working for the Toronto Maple Leafs in the morning and pulling all-nighter shifts at the hospital as she works toward becoming a doctor at night. It's incredible. Yeah.
I will say this, and I do believe women take a lot on their plates, and the women that can do it. I mean, you look at Haley's a perfect example. I mean, and I don't know what that is. I don't know if it's a motherly instinct, if it's just kind of at our core of who we are, but we take a lot on, those of us that want to work hard and want the challenges. And I mean, Haley is, I just can't get over what her schedule is like and what she does for a living and how she's able to do it. And she does it with pride and with a smile on her face, and she's not bashful about it. I mean, she's proud and she deserves to be, because what she does is remarkable work in the community and in the hospital, and it's benefiting lives. You know, I do often think for myself, you know, I love what I do and I think it's great, and we're in the entertainment business, but sometimes you don't feel quite fulfilled because you want to be able to do more and you want to be able to help people. And that's what Haley's doing every single day. So, I mean, I think women are capable and more than capable of taking on a lot of responsibilities at once. And I hope that by seeing people like Haley, young women are encouraged that they can do it too.
With Catherine Tappan of the NHL on NBC, NBC Sports, this is Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. I just want to take your comment about merit a little bit earlier, a step further, Catherine, and get your perspective on this. I mean, I think you, Ziggy, me, we all would agree that a meritorious society is the best society, but the issue is actually on the front end of that, which is equality of opportunity. And it's not just that one receives the same consideration on merit as another. It's that one is not expected to compromise the self in any of a number of ways in order to achieve. How close do you think we are to the equality of opportunity? Because I've often used the example of Usain Bolt. He's the fastest runner in the world. But if I'm running a 100-meter race against Usain Bolt and he's got to start 100 meters back and I'm starting 5 meters from the finish line, I'm going to win regardless of his speed, right? So it's a quality of opportunity. How close are we to that?
Well, I'd like to hope we are close. I think it comes from within. I think people have to reflect on how they want to treat others, but also how they want to be treated themselves. And, you know, I just actually recently was asked, I was interviewed for a podcast, and the person who interviewed me said, you know, how did you become the personality you are on TV? Like, you're so kind and your interviewing skills are great, but like, how did you develop that personality? And I was really quite surprised. I said, I mean, I didn't develop a personality. This is who I am. And I'm proud of who I am, and I'm different than the next person. You know, I'm not Michelle Tafoya. I'm not Liam McHugh. I'm not my colleagues. I'm me. And I encourage this person to be themselves. The person was a little defeated because they said to me, I feel like my personality comes off really harsh and sometimes people don't want to talk to me. And I said, well, you got to find a way to work with that then. Find a way to work with it. Because you're your own individual self. You can't manufacture someone different. And so when you're yourself, you will find the opportunities that are best for you. And I hope that a lot more doors are opening for people of all different kinds, because everyone deserves an opportunity. But again, it goes back to digging within yourself and finding what makes you tick, what makes you work hard and believing in yourself, and then networking and getting out. You know, you've got to find a way to put yourself out there. You can't just assume that the dream job is going to fall from the sky and they're going to come knocking on your door. You got to go get it. And that's a really important thing as well. And I hope that by other people getting opportunities, and you talk about, you know, having a level playing field and getting those opportunities and achieving them on merit, based on merit. And I hope that more and more we see this, then the more and more people will be encouraged to be themselves and encouraged to work hard and fight for their dream.
With Catherine Tappan, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you about the experience covering the great New England Patriots for the 7 years that you did, and for your insight into the dynamic now as Bill Belichick tries to push through with a team that 11 games into its NFL season is under 500 at 5-6, and with some rumblings from down in Tampa Bay that the waters aren't necessarily smooth between Tom Brady and Bruce Arians. What do you make of all of it?
Well, I make of all of it is that it's a lot of chatter and probably not a lot of truth. I've covering the Patriots for so long, you learn so much. I think I learned a lot about covering sports in general, just being in that Wednesday press conference with Bill Belichick every week and not being able to get a lick of information from him. I mean, you find other ways to get it. There's always been, for years, there's been reports about, highs and lows between Belichick and Brady and Kraft and Belichick. And I mean, it's always rumbling because that's what media does. And you've got to find stories. But Tom Brady's the very best. He's the best of the best. And this is a learning experience. I mean, you don't go into a new team and expect to win a Super Bowl. You just don't. And he's got different weapons around him. And of course, there's going to be frustrations. He's a complete perfectionist. And he's, this is the way he was in New England, too, when they were a dynasty and they were winning every game every week. And he still found a way to find something that needed to be worked on. So, Belichick has his hands full with a new team, with a totally new quarterback, with a different operating system. And he functions totally different than Tom Brady. And sometimes he doesn't function well at all. And sometimes he's out with COVID. And I mean, these are the challenges that Belichick has to navigate through with a whole new dynamic with his team. And then Brady has to do the same thing in Tampa. So anybody that expected either one of these two teams to have, just come out of the gates running and be successful this season, I think you would have been fooled. And add in all the challenges that everybody's dealing with right now with, players are in and out any given week. I mean, you don't even look at the Ravens. I mean, look at the Broncos last week with no quarterback. I mean, that's unbelievable. So you can't expect it this year, but I think the rift between Brady and Arians is nowhere near what it is being portrayed to be. I think behind closed doors, they're two pros. They're two of the best to do what they do. I mean, Bruce Arians is an incredible coach, and I think Brady has a lot of respect for him. So you'll see it turn around. I mean, it's a lot of chatter, and I don't know. Sometimes it's a lot of noise.
I have to ask you about...
I don't know if that's what you want to hear. Are you guys Patriots fans?
Well, we're here for the drama.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We got to compare Brady and Belichick from now until the rest of our lives, Catherine. I mean, this is the truth of the matter,
true.
Right?
Yeah, it's the best.
Better you than me.
Yes.
You're going to have some rough mornings.
I got to ask you about college and running the steeplechase, because me and Scotty are always trying to figure out who's better in what different areas of athleticism. And me and him had a hit off this year trying to hit a 90 mile an hour fastball. Do you think me and Scotty could actually get over the big hurdle and get over the water
without
no chance,
without a hernia or a torn quad or hammy?
No chance. I don't think I could get over the hurdles at this point in my life. I think it's funny that people bring that up a lot, because it is a really unique event, and they introduced it my sophomore year in college. Men's college running, Division I, was running the steeplechase at the time, and then they introduced it for women's running. And my coach, I was an intermediate hurdler in high school, and I was a distance runner in college. So she said, "Oh, you'd be great at the steeplechase." And I'm like, "What the heck? Isn't that for horses? You have no idea what this event is." And it's a challenge. I mean, that first race of the season, we were usually in Miami for the Miami Invitational, and it's exhausting. It's completely exhausting. And by the time you get to, at the time, Rutgers was in the Big East, but the time you get to the Big East Championship and the NCAAs, you're more in shape for it. But I mean, it's five barriers for seven laps, and one of them's a water pit every time. So your feet are wet the second you start. And then you come home and you take your, you get off the field and you're getting on the bus to go home wherever you are, and you're putting your wet cleats and wet socks in your backpack. And it's just, you get home like 8 hours later and your roommates are like, "Get those out of the room. They stink." it takes a special breed to run that race. But again, getting back to you guys doing it, I would applaud you if you tried. I would not encourage it. Maybe lower the barrier a little bit, maybe make it like a foot off the ground.
Well, Catherine, I mean, I got to be honest about this. I challenge Ziggy to a 100-yard race, goalpost to goalpost on a football field, and he's the ex-pro athlete, and he's the one who's delaying this, who's saying no. So, I mean, it's funny. It's funny. He's trying. It's funny. He's trying to paint himself as the guy who wants to do the steeplechase when he doesn't even want to put one foot in front of the other. I mean, you know. Thanks so much.
When you compete all those years, he's retired now. He's ready to, you know.
Yes, exactly.
He's sitting and talking to you.
Thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate it, and we hope we can have you on again, especially as well. Our fingers are crossed. We get closer to the start of an actual NHL season.
Yes, you got it, guys. Anytime. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Catherine Tappan of NBC Sports, the NHL on NBC. Okay, so Catherine's chimed in.
She's pretty much said we're not going to be able to get through the water. So if you don't know what the steeplechase is, there's one big obstacle every lap, and it's a massive hurdle that you kind of step on and jump over, but then there's a huge water pit after it. And pretty much she said, one, we won't get over the hurdle, and two, we're probably going to walk through. It's like a couple feet of water.
Why are you even talking like this is going to happen? You won't even run a race from one goalpost on a football field to another against me. And now you want us trudging through quicksand and water and
I'd be
hurdles?
More interested in the steeplechase. I think that would make for better
theater. if you can find a course, we'll do it. So Catherine Tappan doesn't think there's much to the Brady Belichick stuff.
No.
We'll see what Adnan Virk has to say, because it's his co-host, Michael Lombardi, on the GM Shuffle podcast, who's opining that the Arians-Brady relationship in Tampa Bay isn't quite so warm right now. Adnan Virk next. Yeah, I have to admit, I feel a little better about myself when a true professional like Adnan Virk is just as pissy on Twitter about his favorite football team as I get about mine. Adnan was typing on Monday night when the Seahawks were visiting his beloved Eagles. He had some thoughts and he shared them. And he's with us now. You couldn't contain that emotion, right?
The agito is just boiling over, Scotty Mac. And it's funny. Normally, you know, you like to use Twitter in a positive medium. Hey, let me share this positive story. Let me thank this person. Let me express gratitude. But let's be honest. It's a great place to spew some vitriol and to get some anger into your system. And that's what I was using on Monday night. I've been the biggest Wentz apologist, but God, enough is enough. What a miserable
game. But what do you mean by enough is enough? Because if they move on from him, which I don't think they will for this reason, it's a 59, say that again, $59 million cap hit in 2021. Like, ain't happening.
No, it's insane. They put that graphic up and you go, all right, well, he's definitely not getting cut. Like, if you want to entertain trade options, okay. This is not the time you want to be trading low and trying to get value for a guy who's been great in the past and now has been miserable. But that's your only option, because you're right. $59 million to cut him next year. If you cut him in 2022, I believe it goes down to about $23 million. So it's obviously more palatable, still not ideal. But at the very least, I just thought we'd see more Jalen Hurts. The rumors were coming out, Scotty and Ziggy, that, all right, if Wentz struggles again, we're going to see some of Jalen Hurts. And then we didn't. We saw him on the field with Wentz. We saw him one other time. Throw a pass for 6 yards, and that's it. And listen, I understand Wentz has been your franchise quarterback. You're paying him a ton of money. But why can't we just see a little bit of Jalen Hurts? If you're going to use him here and there sporadically, why not use him for more series just to see what you have at this point? I mean, you're a terrible football team. You're 3-7-1. I think the fact that the NFC East is up for grabs has hurt them, because they think, hey, you know what? All along, prior to this week, hey, we're still in first place, guys. You know, hey, crazy as it is. And that's harmful, because – it sells you into thinking you're better than you are. And you go, no, listen, you're a very sub-500 team. If they weren't anywhere close, guys, to the division title, and right now I think they'd say, you know what, let's just see what we got in Jalen Hurts. Let's just play him a quarter. Play him a half. Why not? But because the division's there, they're like, oh, you know what, can't do this. As Doug Peterson said a week ago, it would send the wrong message. Well, playing him right now is sending the wrong message, because the whole team is terrible. And listen, I can criticize the offensive line all day. It's not his fault that he leads the league in sacks. It's him holding the ball too long, but also the offensive line. The receiving core is miserable. You don't see any explosiveness. And Scotty, how about every single team? And we can mention this over and over because it's true. Passing on DK Metcalf. Like, you're watching DK Metcalf in that game go, oh, that's exactly what the Eagles could use. A playmaker, a guy with explosiveness, a dynamic player. That's on Howie Roseman, not drafting a guy like that.
Yeah, I'm with you on the Hurts stuff. It's leave him in for a drive. I don't understand one play here or a play there. It just doesn't make any sense. Before we get to the serious issues of the day, though, can you please tell me why they went for 2 points at the end of the game because I had the Seahawks.
He had the Seahawks minus 6.5 and and he's still mad.
Hello?
Do we have Adnan?
Oh.
Did we get Opaled? Are you there?
I'm here, boys. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, so Ziggy's mad that...
the 2 points at the end. Right, how ridiculous was that, by the way?
I mean, Seattle was favored by 6.5, right? So Philly got covered.
Well, this is one of those examples. You go, this is why you don't gamble. Because you're watching that game going, oh, my God. Thank God you picked Seattle. Philadelphia looks terrible. Oh, this game's... It wasn't a blowout, but never really in doubt. And then once Seattle scored the late touch, you're like, you're good. And then you're like, wait, are you kidding? They score that kind of a ridiculous touchdown and then go for two. And I'm like... This is why you don't gamble, Ziggy. The gambling gods, the guys in the desert, they always know more than the rest of us. Don't you know that by now?
Oh, gosh. I couldn't get over that. I literally was up all night. I had 1 hour of sleep before yesterday. It was absolutely an awful
because
night.
Of that outcome, that impacts you.
Yes, yes.
How much money did we have in the game, Ziggy? That's not good.
I couldn't handle it. I can't handle it. When I see the 91% of people bettors put money on the Seahawks and they just magically throw the Hail Mary, magically go for two, I don't get it. I don't get it.
No, and it raises a larger question of Doug Peterson's play calling. And they just haven't been the same team without Frank Reich. He's a great offensive coordinator for them when they went to the Super Bowl and won. Since then, he's proven he's a really good coach with Indianapolis. And too often, I find the Eagles, like, they're successful at running the ball. Miles Sanders is top five right now in yards per carry. But then Doug Peterson just gets kind of bored. He's like, ah, you know, I'm tired of running the ball. Let's just throw the ball. Their offense really could use a lot of work. And it starts with the play calling. There's no question about it.
And just to put a bow on that, if you multiplied the amount of money Ziggy had on that game by zero, you would get zero.
I got my locks on the line here.
The amount of money he had on that game by 100 million, you'd get zero. but the thing is that Ziggy locks mean a lot to him. And, that's why we run the disclaimer each and every week here at Sportsnet 590, The Fan, that there is a do not bet on the Ziggy.
Leadoff is not responsible for any money lost on a Ziggy lock.
Exactly. So we want your insight because your co-host on the GM Shuffle podcast has penned a piece in The Athletic, Michael Lombardi, opining that the Brady-Arians relationship in Tampa Bay ain't so warm. Now, the Bucs have a winning record. I think odds are that they will make the playoffs as opposed to miss them. They'll have to go on the road if they're going to make it to the Super Bowl, though. That division effectively belongs to New Orleans now, both by record and then should they end up tied with the tiebreak. What is your sense of what is going on in Tampa Bay?
Well, I thought Michael really, you know, broke it down in a really, really strong, constructive manner. And not only his work in The Athletic, but you can, of course, listen to our podcast, The GM Shuffle. And the main thesis of his argument, boys, was that there's just a real disconnect between Brady and Arians. And the offense that Brady wants to run is different than Bruce's offense. And if you're the Buccaneers right now, I agree that there's too much hand-wringing over the state of the team. I mean, they are 7-5. I mean, this has never been a particularly strong franchise in recent years. And I agree with you, Scotty. They're going to make the playoffs. The NFC, after the seven teams that make the playoffs, you see a drop-off. I mean, the Bears, the Vikings, those teams right now on the outside looking in, you can feel like they're more, you know, pretenders rather than contenders, which isn't even to mention the NFC East champion, whoever they're going to be. But Tampa's going to make the playoffs. But Mike's point is this. ultimately, the offense that Brady wants and what Arians wants is different. And these guys, he goes, very clearly are taking shots at each other. You know, if you listen to that broadcast, you can hear Romo basically taking Brady saying, you know what, Tom just isn't comfortable the way that they're doing certain things. And Arians has been very blunt in his assessment after games. So, no, I think just Tom's not reading the defense as well. Like he's made it clear that in practice, those deep balls look good. But in the game, there's a little bit of inaccuracy. And at times, they say, okay, yeah, sure, the running backs, you know, Fournette's got to do a better job of making a catch. And But Arians has not been protective of Brady. I think he's been very clear that, you know what, I'm going to be honest, and this is what I see. And Lombardi's point is this. At the end of this year, you're going to have to make a decision. You're either going to say, all right, Tom Brady's 43 years old. Let's go one more year of Tom or two more years of Tom. Brady wants to play until he's 45, and we trust him to run this offense, whatever you want. You want Antonio Brown? Here, you got him, man. Whatever you need, Tom, we're going to do it. Or you go with Arians, a guy in his late 60s, and say, all right, clearly you and Brady did not mesh when it came to your offensive philosophies. Bruce, who do you want to be the quarterback? Tom, see you later. And that's pretty bold that right now Lombardi's the guy saying, I don't care if they go 9-7 or 10-6 and make the playoffs. Long term, this isn't going to work. And I think if you watch games really closely, you can see that this offense, considering their weapons, really hasn't taken flight the way I think most of us thought they would.
So you think AB has now, well, what are they, 1-3 now with AB? Do you think he's actually hurt the Bucs?
I wouldn't go that far, Ziggy, because I do think he's been productive. And, you know, I think what ends up happening is that sometimes you have that embarrassment of riches theory, and you go, well, hey, we already have two good receivers. Why not have a third? Well, then other times maybe, you know, Brady can be too desirous of looking for AB, and he isn't even targeting Evans or Godwin as much. So I think Brown's been – listen, we haven't had any stories about him, right? So that's already a win. There hasn't been any issues about him. And same as for Antonio Brown, there's never been any issues about work ethic or anything like that. I mean, he comes to play, and he works hard. He does what he does. It's all the other stuff that you can't deal with. And he's obviously, you know, volatile in that department. But he's been a good boy in that respect, so to speak. And he's staying at Tom Brady's place. So that's good news. Brady, keep an eye on him. And I don't think it's hurt them in that respect. I just think in terms of spreading the offensive around, you know, getting the run game going with Fournette, it just, you can sense that they always seem to be a little bit of a beat off. And so much of football is about timing and being in rhythm. And the Bucs' rhythm is just, it's a little bit off. And it needs to be recalibrated or they're going to have some issues.
I'll throw another thought at you as to why this won't work in the longer term, Adnan. Tom Brady's 43.
Yeah.
Like, no, I don't get, and again, this will all play out over time, but I don't understand why the discussion about Tom Brady's age is handled like we would a hot stove. We don't want to touch it. You know, like at some point, I don't care how great he's been, and he has been great and is arguably the best ever, perhaps inarguably the best ever. Father Time is going to come for him no matter how many of the magic blueberries he eats.
And that's why I think ultimately, Scotty, Arians is going to win this battle. You know what I mean? Maybe Brady wins the war, but ultimately the battle is won by Arians because long term, as you point out, your answer is not going to be Tom Brady because he's 43. You know, he says he wanted to play until he's 45. So theoretically, two more years after this. But I think all of us could agree watching Tom Brady, he's not the same player he once was. And that's fine. For God's sakes, he's 43. You would think he would lost a little bit of zip on his fastball. He was never a great deep ball thrower. And I think that was one of those odd parts of it. Tampa, we said, oh my God, they got all these burners at receiver. Wait until they air it out. And I'm like, well, that's never really been Brady's thing. I'm not calling him a dink and dunk quarterback, but, you know, just focus on the slants rather than the go routes, and we're going to be a lot better off here. And that's where it's just felt uneasy at times. And like I said, that timing is a little bit off. And ultimately, I think Tampa Bay, after this season, if Bruce gets what he wants, Arians goes in there and is honest, says, you know what, Brady isn't the right fit for us. But I think Tampa Bay will say, okay, you know what, Tom, sorry, all the best. You can find some other place to play for a year or two. And he will get a job somewhere. He's Tom Brady. But I just think for Tampa, it's not going to be the right spot.
With Adnan Virk, Alan Walsh's tweets have become like a pack-a-day Du Maurier habit for me. I can't. I'm addicted, man. Like,
well done.
I don't. He. I mean, this is a player agent, so he's on the inside, and he knows stuff. So Ziggy and I were talking. We spent, I think, essentially the first segment of the show, the first 20, 22 minutes of the show, talking about this. Like, are we at a point here where we should actually be worried about whether there is going to be a season or is this a Bettman down the escalator moment in 2013 where Gary said, look, there's not going to be a season, and a week later we had peace and a lockout shortened year in 2013. I can't imagine they don't play, but man, is the rhetoric hot right now.
Yeah, I think in every labor negotiation, Scotty, there always is that back and forth of, oh my God, it's never been this bad. I don't know how a deal is going to get done. This one's going to have to go down to the wire. And then at some point, one side says, no, it's not happening. The other side says, oh yeah, you know what? We already told them it's not happening. And so that very public spat often happens. But I think generally speaking, cooler heads have to prevail, and both sides sit down and go, really? Do we really want to do this? Forget about the money. Forget about all the money we're forfeiting for the year. Look at the damage we're going to cause the game, the way we'll alienate fans, the way that we'll frustrate people dealing with just a horrible, horrible circumstances during this pandemic. We really want to do this? Like, are you sure, guys? And that's where I think that they come to the table. But I do think that rhetoric, it's not phony. I do think there's genuine frustration on both sides. You know, the NHL owners are saying, hey, guys, you know, however many games we play, you do realize if we're going no fans, if we're losing a ton of money here, there's no sport more dependent to the big four in America on the gate like the NHL. They need that attendance money from the fans coming to games and concessions and parking and food and all the rest of it. So, and I think from the players' perspective, like, listen, we get that. Let's work out a deal here, but don't try to treat us like children. Don't lay down the law and give us this ultimatum, because then all of a sudden we get frustrated by that. Because guess what? The fans come to see us. And it's that always age-old argument between labor and ownership. But to your point, Scotty, why there should be apprehension and trepidation is that the NBA is ready to get going here. Like, they've already announced their Christmas Day schedule, training camp's opening. Like, come hell or high water, December 22nd, we're getting some NBA games. And it's going to be messy. There's going to be guys testing positive. I think there's going to be lots of cancellations, but they're going to give it a go. And originally, the players want to start Martin Luther King weekend, which in America is in mid-January, January 18th or so. And Adam Silver implored us, listen, by waiting a month, rather than starting December 22nd, we're going to lose about $500 million. So you want to just help us out, just start this thing earlier before Christmas? And the players are like, okay, like, if it's that much money at stake and all of a sudden our money is going to be impacted as well, then let's do this. So hockey's going to be smarter about it and figure out a way, because the NBA announced this date, you know, a few weeks ago, and at least then the free agents frenzy happened, now training camps. The NHL, it's been, hey, sometime in January they're going to start. Well, there's really been no movement. We've got to get training camps going at some point. So I would be concerned, but I don't think we're quite at DEFCON 5.
All right, on our way out, last Thursday before the slate of NFL games for Thanksgiving down in the U.S., we sat around the table and we each took a team to win the NFC East. Ziggy picked Dallas. That doesn't look quite so hot now because the Washington football team went down there and won on Thursday. Hugh Burl is actually a Washington football team fan, so he's got them. I've got the Nye Giants. You'll be our Eagles guy.
Yeah.
So now we've got the four of us, each with a team in the NFC East.
Somebody's going to the playoffs.
Somebody's got to go. Do you still think it will be your Eagles? Because I'm feeling good about my Giants.
Yeah, I was confident about the Eagles all along because I kept telling myself, well, they're still in first. Yeah, they're still in first. Okay. And then the last, once you go to a three-game losing streak, and I saw the schedule, I said, all right, this is going to be tough to pick up a win here. And that loss, particularly to Cleveland, like, I can't believe I'm actually saying this out loud, but the fact that they lost to Cleveland, I was like, all right, now we're in trouble. Cleveland is actually a good team. They can run the ball well. They've got a great defense with Myles Garrett and company. Mayfield just doesn't make mistakes. That loss against Cleveland really hurt them because Seattle on Monday night, I said, okay, this one you're going to be hard-pressed to win. Now it's a must-win against the Packers coming up on Sunday for Philly. So, listen, I try to tell myself this. At 3-7-1, if they go 3-2, if Philadelphia can go 3-2, they'll be 6-9-1, and I believe that's enough to win the division. Having said that, I'm expecting a team that's winning games at like a 40% clip to all of a sudden play above 500 for five games. That feels like a reach. The Giants, I think, are playing better football than any of those other teams. Their defense is playing a lot better. They've acquired a semblance of a running game. But now Daniel Jones is out for a couple weeks. So the team I'm probably most confident of is Hugh Burrell's Washington football team. A great defensive line. They're able to impact the game significantly, give a short field to Alex Smith. I don't think he makes too many mistakes. The dreaded game manager label. But in this instance, I'm making it a compliment towards him. I think that Washington can do enough to, yes, win the division, the third team ever, with a losing record.
Yay or nay on your way out the door, when we talk next Wednesday, a major, and by that I mean like a George Springer type, a major, major league free agent has signed somewhere.
I'm going to say nay. It's going to happen this month, Scotty, but I don't know if in the next week before we talk. But one of those guys, yes, one of those dominoes will fall. Bauer, Springer, Rail, Muto, et cetera. But I don't think by next week. They're taking their time.
All right, we'll chat. Thanks, pal.
Great stuff, boys. Thank you.
You bet. Anand Vurik of MLB Network, NHL Network, and the GM Shuffle Pod. Hugh joins us in studio next. Happy birthday, Brittany. 39? Is that the...
All right. Britney Spears is 39 years old. Think about that.
Blast from the past.
Yep. Top five Britney Spears songs. Go.
I can't even name.
Go through that at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Can I? Yeah. We'll give you a couple of days to work on that. Yeah.
This one.
This is my favorite.
This one is a good one. All right. Ziggy Locke. Almost forgot this because we never have football from the NFL on a Wednesday. Pittsburgh favored by 10.5 at home.
10.5
this afternoon over your hashtag Ravens flock.
So Lamar Jackson's not in. We got RG3 going in. He's only taken a little over a dozen snaps. Steelers defense is, one of the best in the league. Big Ben, I don't know. 10.5's a huge number. I'm gonna have to go Steelers and go against my Ravens.
Bam, bam, bam.
Too many guys
Ravens
are in the lineup.
Ravens flock is not going to be happy with you, Zig.
Yeah, we just don't know who's in, who's out. Their COVID's hit them. They don't have, they've even lost coaches. I think that's going to be a bigger issue than even Lamar not going in.
The Ravens are staring down the barrel of 6-5 if they just straight up lose this game this afternoon. We'll break it down tomorrow morning at 6. Good shows next. Have a great hump day in beautiful Green Bay, Wisconsin. If you